want to say a few words to all of you guests who have come here now. Soon Jus Backen, he's saying farewell, and welcome back again. Another year or next summer or so here. I'm saying that this to all those who are leaving today. And I want to say that 3 months ago, this house was an empty house. There was no people. And there was nobody here. In the fields outside, there was no vegetables. There was just lots of weeds, nothing. And much is happening here, all the time. I think Jus Backen now is in a state of experimental workshop of living. It's a constant creation and a constant state of learning. And I want to thank you, Vimala, for helping us in the process of creating this place, and everyone else who has been here. Also, I want to thank all the guests for coming here and being here and sharing life with us. Your being here has inspired us very much. All of your being here, I think, and all of you bring here new means of communication, I think, and you reflect and reinforce tranquility and understanding of being in the now and being in the here, learning. I also want to thank Pamela for taking care of the kitchen and everyone who has helped in these things, and all the guests who helped in doing whatever was necessary. I think everything has worked quite fine, considering the creation process of the place. So finally, I don't know how we can thank you, Vimala, for what we have learned together in this room and on our still journey. Let me only offer you two flowers here.
Three months ago, if somebody would have told me that I would be in Sweden, somewhere in the interior, conducting a camp, I wouldn't have believed it. I have never been to Sweden before, and have had no acquaintances really in Sweden. But the Norwegian camp held in Sweden has given me an opportunity to meet both the Norwegians and the youth from Sweden. All of you who have decided to live in this place, experiment in growing together inwardly and outwardly. Are on a way to take up the challenge of modern life in a creative way. If the revolts, the rejections, the reactions, do not remain at that level, but get enriched by a positive and a creative perspective of total life, this place can become a cell, a living cell of total revolution, revolution in man, his psyche, his way of living, his texture of relationships, and so on. But it is extremely difficult to maintain the balance between the inner and the outer. Sometimes the outward form of the experiment becomes very heavy and doesn't allow the time and the energy and the quietness to the inmates of the place to watch and see if the inner growth accompanies the outer growth. Though it is remarkable and creditable, and I wish well to every one of you, it's easy comparatively to grow vegetables, fruits, the farm, and perhaps by next year you will have your own cereals. It requires work, but comparatively it is easier than to grow inwardly. And the inward growth, the total growth, does not imply only intellectual growth, but the intellectual, the emotional, and transcending them, the growth of the intelligence, and so on. So I'm glad a handful of youth has taken up the challenge of a transformation in man and his way of living. And I'm thankful on behalf of myself, as well as those who have come from outside of Sweden to attend the camp. Thankful to all of you who have received us and cooperated with us and have taken the trouble to see that you could make our stay as comfortable as it was possible for you. Thank you. As I was saying a couple of minutes ago, the fundamental challenge before you and me is to let a new human being be born of ourselves and from within ourselves, a new way of living, a new perspective of life, a new movement of intelligence within us. That is really the issue before a sensitive and alert human being who has seen the futility of the established ways of living. So one has to have the humility to say to oneself, man has not discovered the way to live individually and collectively in peace, freedom, and tranquility or relaxation. So I do not know how to live. Man does not know how to live. Let me find out. If there is this verbalized admission to oneself, that man in general and I in particular do not know how to live, and I have to find out, I have to learn, I have to discover, then the beginning of revolution is in the innocency of humility. Not in the arrogance of, I know this much, this is not sufficient, so I will acquire more knowledge. The structure of experiences, sensual and psychological, that I have do not satisfy me. They are insufficient. So let me find out another way of experiencing, or another field of experiencing. the arrogance of the ego, the self, the me, to hunt for new ways of thinking, new patterns of behavior, new ways of experiences. It creates an invisible circumference around oneself. The acquisitive tendency keeps you a prisoner in the field of the known. Because the moment you say, this is insufficient, let me acquire more, this bores me, let me find out and acquire new experiences, then the acquisitive tendency retains the I, the ego, the self, the me at the center. The field of the known and the experience and the inheritance around the me. And the movement is always within these frontiers of the known. The known of the individual and the known of the total human race. Experiences of the individual and of the total human race. So, one has to watch and find out at the very beginning, at the very first step, whether it is the acquisitive ambition that is leading me towards this so-called religious field, or this is the humility and innocence to learn, to find out, to discover. These two will lead in diametrically opposite directions. If it is the ambition, if it is the acquisitive tendency, then the knowledge, the experience will dominate over you. The past will dominate over the inquiry, color the perception, twist and distort the perception and the responses. But when you say, I do not know, I really don't know how to live, it seems that man has not found it out. Let me, in my own life, as a representative of the total human race, let me take a step and find out. Not only for the self-centered motive of escaping the boredom or escaping the corrupt society, escaping the violence, not only with that self-centered or selfish motive, but being aware that I carry within me the residue of the total human knowledge and experience as a representative of the total human race. In the light of that awareness of the total human problem, I proceed with the inquiry. You know, that gives you a sense of responsibility. Along with the humility, along with the innocency, along with the openness and vulnerability to learn, to grow, to discover, to plunge into an uncharted sea where there are no blueprints and no chalked out paths and ways. To plunge into that ocean, the vast ocean of the unknown within myself. So the urge to learn and the urge to acquire, these two lead to diametrically opposite directions. Supposing that those of us who have been together for the last 1 week have that humility, that openness, that sense of responsibility, that we are not satisfied only with rejecting the established, revolting against the established ways of living, but we are deeply concerned and we do feel committed to discover a new way of living. Because rejection, to reject, to revolt, to rebel, to negate, to criticize, to condemn, gives you a kind of satisfaction. It makes you feel as if you are a revolutionary. That's a pure and simple negative way. One can just deny, reject, revolt against the established ways and lapse into a lazy indulgence of the sensual life under the name of non-conformity. The cult of indulgence is as dangerous as the cult of denial, self-denial. The cult of indulgence in sensual or psychological pleasure is as dangerous, if not more, as the cult of suppression and repression of physical and psychological pleasures. We have to steer clear of these two extremes, the cult of indulgence and the cult of suppression, repression. So supposing that those of us who have been together and are together are desirous of steering clear of the two extremes and keeping to the middle, and to proceed with the investigation and the examination, what do they do? First thing, they find out what their conditionings are. They find out the pattern of their behavior. They find out the structure of habits that they have. They find out how much time they spend in repeating activities out of a habit. Behaving out of a habit pattern, mechanically, passively. This process of self-acquaintance is vitally necessary. Unless I know and unless I understand the contents of my conditionings and their ways of operating, I can't take a step further. Unless you discover the earth of the nature of the earth on which you have to walk, the surface, whether it has pits, ditches, whether you have to climb, what kind of surface the earth has, and how is it solid or soft, muddy, slippery. You have to find out for yourself, not go by the description. You might read all the books in the world and read the descriptions of the experiences, searches of other people, prophets and saints and sages and yogis and sannyasis. You may read the descriptions, verbalized descriptions of their own experiences. But you cannot feed intelligence upon descriptions and verbalizations. Intelligence thrives on personal discovery, personal encounter. So when you go out for a walk, you discover. So, as you have to discover the nature of the ground, the floor, the earth, upon which you want to walk or run or climb or dance, in the same way, before you transcend the conditionings, you have to get acquainted with their nature and modus operandi. You can never dodge your own conditionings. You can't wish them away. You can't explain them away. You can't analyze and leave them there. So instead of going in for an indirect process of acquiring information about the human conditionings through talks, discourses or books, a revolutionary person begins to watch his daily life and find out the amount of slavery to the past in which he lives. To discover the content of bondage and the modus operandi of the bondage is already halfway to freedom. It's the beginning of freedom. So I discover, I observe and watch my way of daily living. What we call daily living is the only life that we have. You cannot divide life into daily living and occasional religious living. You cannot divide and fragment life into secular and religious, mundane and spiritual. Life is one indivisible whole. And it either becomes secular or spiritual according to the quality that you bring to your action, to your relationships, to your attitudes, to your perspectives, and so on. So I get acquainted with my conditionings. The hatred for conditionings, the contempt for conditionings is as dangerous as the ignorance about conditionings. then you will begin to hate yourself. You will begin to feel an inferiority complex that my conditionings are not good and those who are born in India have better conditionings. Or the Indians might feel those who are born in the affluent countries have better conditionings. This contempt, hatred, indifference about one's own conditionings poisons and pollutes the religious inquiry at the very source. You know, very few of us have real love for ourselves, a respect, a reverence for ourselves, for the physical, for the mental, for the verbal structures that we have. Whether we torture the bodies in the name of religion and spirituality, or whether we drag down the body and the senses to the vulgar level of providing pleasure to us all the time. We have no relationship of love, concern, care, affection, or respect for ourselves. And what I am trying to say before I depart from you this morning, love of life begins with love of oneself. Whatever the conditionings, whatever the uglinesses and weaknesses that one has, to get acquainted with them, to discover them in a friendly way, to have a relationship of affection and friendship with the conditionings. So you observe them with care and the tenderness of affection. And as a friend, not as an authority, I would like to communicate this simple truth to you, that when you become friendly with the body, the mind, when you become friendly with the conditionings, and you become aware of their limitations, their one-sidedness, they don't bother you anymore. Being born, brought up in a Brahmin Hindu family, that too in India, one has seen what the conditionings are, how deep-rooted they can be. But once you see them, once they are exposed to the light of your observation and attention, they lose the grip over you. They lose the grip over your perception. They can no more distort your perception. They can no more distort, twist, or contaminate your responses. They are there. They are not destroyed. They are not eliminated. But they are rendered effectless, incompetent, sterile, the moment you look at them. Don't you dry your clothes in the open sunshine and the air? You air the clothes. You expose them to the sunshine. And the sunshine does the rest. In the same way, when you observe the conditionings as they are, without the feeling of condemnation, hatred, without the feeling of inferiority, contempt, when you allow them to be exposed to your attention, to your observation, to your intelligence, it is like airing the clothes. It's like putting the clothes on the line under the open skies where the rays of the sun do the rest of purifying them, cleaning them. So the inquirer sets about observing the content of his mind, the content of his psyche. He sets about to get acquainted with the so-called known. You know, the known is not with which we are acquainted. We take for granted the known. We take for granted the inherited. And the job is to go through a personal acquaintance with them. So you pierce through the known. You are aware of the known, of the conditionings, of the feelings, of the patterns of your reactions, of your likes and dislikes. All the time, while you are with people, while you are with yourself, while you are with nature, you are aware of the conditionings. That is what happens after the acquaintance. You don't have to remember them. You don't have to analyze them. You don't have to make an effort to suppress them. The awareness does the rest. Because in behavior, in relationships, when your past, your known, or the known and the past of the total human race begins to move within you, when the tide of the past begins to well up, surge up in your heart, in reaction to an objective challenge or a relationship, you are ahead of that tide. Your intelligence, your attention is there to be aware of the welling up, surging up of the reaction. The past comes up. It has its own momentum. So as soon as you move into a relationship, the word, the gesture, the behavior, the action or the inaction, the indifference of another person, the brutality, the violence of the other person, it somewhere hits the past. It affects the past, and the past within yourself, the known, the conditioned, begins to well up. It requires time to describe all this, but when it happens within you, it happens with a frightening speed. The past wells up. But the sensitivity, the intelligence, is aware of that past coming up. It does not try to suppress the tide, but it is there with all the sharpness of awareness. So when the past comes up, while you are in relationship throughout the day, whether at home or at your workshop, office, business, factory and so on, or with people, then you are aware of the objective challenge and your subjective reaction. The intelligence is always on a different plane, as it were. Intelligence is never imprisoned by the past. That unconditioned energy is never contaminated by the touch of the intellect, the touch of the thought, the touch of the past. As love is never polluted by the touch of the mind or thought, innocency or humility is never contaminated by thought and time. In the same way, intelligence is always outside the area of the known, the past. So the awareness of the past coming up is there, and when the past comes up, it's like dead ashes, empty ashes. It has no fire left within to distort your relationship with other people. And if the person has equipped his body, his speech, his whole being with sensitivity, if he has gone through the purification of a scientific approach to diet, to exercise, to sleep, to the whole way of living, then the past is exposed once to the attention, to the awareness, and there is an end to it. It depends upon the physical, the verbal, and the mental structure of an inquirer. Because the purification through a scientific approach, for me purity means a scientific approach. Austerity implies a scientific approach of accuracy and precision, where there is no postponement. You understand and you live that understanding without a time lag. That is a scientific approach. If you are in a laboratory doing this research, physics or chemistry or biology, nuclear physics and so on, as soon as you realize the mistake, You don't say, all right, it's a very small mistake, doesn't matter, I'll continue. The minutest detail of inaccuracy or imprecision is taken care of. And the next moment, your experiment is free from that imprecision and inaccuracy. In the same way, a revolutionary person who is exploring the inner space of intelligence, who is exploring the new dimensions of human psyche, has to move in life with extreme, intense accuracy and precision. We are the explorers of new ways of living, mind you. It's not discovery of America or discovery of India or Asia, not discovery of new medicines or an electronic brain. It's a discovery of whether there is life beyond brain, beyond thought, whether there is life beyond matter, whether there is life beyond energy and the movement of energy, into which man can be born voluntarily. So, the past, the conditionings, they come up, exposed to the attention, they are rendered lifeless, sterile. And there is an end to the bondage and beginning of freedom. It is not the conditionings that are the content of bondage. It is my attachment to the conditionings. It is my identification to the conditionings which is the content of bondage, not the conditionings themselves. If I look upon this body as a bondage, then there is no beginning of freedom, no possibility of a revolution at all. It's my relationship to the body, with the body, that determines whether I live in freedom or in bondage. So as one would like to explore what is life beyond thought, mind, brain, what is life beyond matter and energy, one will have in all humility to put aside all the known, the past, the conditionings. You cannot choose and say, out of the past I will accept the authority of what I think to be good and I reject the other parts of the known and the past because I think they are undesirable. If you begin to accept the authority of the past, you may choose and select. You may make a comparative study of religions the world over, the scriptures of all the religions, all the methods and techniques that they have had, and you may say, now I choose that much out of the past. I accept the authority of the Vedas, the Upanishads, the New Testament, the Zendavesta, the Quran, and so on, or the Dhammapada. I accept not the total Dhammapada, but I accept the Diamond Sutra, and so on. If I try to choose and select out of the past and accept the authority of that much, acceptance of that authority will become the greatest obstacle in the discovery of the new. Because the good and the bad, they go together. If you accept the authority of one fragment of the past, then that very delicate thread of your selected ideology, very tender silken thread of your chosen and selected values, theories or conclusions of the past, that silk thread of authority has the strength to bring with it the total past in its wake. So one has to brush aside the authority of the past. I talked about the past. Now I am talking about our relationship to the past. But we are attached to the past and we like to accept the authority of the past. It is the acceptance of authority in the hope of security that keeps us away from freedom. And please do see that one doesn't have to condemn or speak about the past in a derogatory sense. I, for one, would not say that all that the people in the past have done is idiotic or silly or foolish. This cult of denial, condemnation of the past, has become fashionable in the world. Last 50 years or so. Then, if you condemn, if you belittle it, if you talk about your own past and the total past of human race in a derogatory sense, with a feeling of contempt for it, it results in an intellectual arrogance or a feeling of self-righteousness, a feeling of a complex of superiority that nobody knew anything. Everything is wrong. Everything was wrong. So the beginning of a revolutionary investigation and examination gets the foundation of bitterness, cynicism, self-righteousness, or the arrogance of feeling oneself terribly superior over others. It can never lead to compassion for the living and the dead, for the whole of life. So I say to myself, well, this is the past, whatever they have done. But I do not accept the authority of the past and do not follow them, do not conform to the theories, the conclusions of other people, because the meaning of life cannot be borrowed. As beauty and love and humility cannot be borrowed, bought or stolen, the meaning of life cannot be borrowed. It may be the conclusion, the theory of the Vedas, may be the most beautiful, Vedanta, may be the most beautiful expression of Jesus of Nazareth. But if I try to borrow it ready-made from Jesus, or a Buddha, or a Confucius, or a Lao Tse, or a Krishnamurti, or a Rammurti, XYZ, if you try to borrow, then you try to graft the experience, the conclusion, or the theory, or the way of living of that person upon yourself. So neither condemnation. In condemning, you are really accepting the authority. Otherwise, why should you condemn? Why should you have a contempt? You just don't accept the authority. So to keep oneself free of the authority, saying, what the living or the dead have done, they might have had their relevance to do, but I would like to live, not as a second-hand copy of someone else, but I would like to live and kindle maybe the small lamp that I have. I would like to kindle my own awareness, to live in the light of my own, of the intelligence that is operating and functioning in and through me. So you brush aside the past with gratefulness, with humility, in modesty, and not with arrogance or bitterness or cynicism. You know, the attitude with which you take the steps takes you very far. It carries with it either the beauty of harmony and relaxation of affection and love, or the rigidity and stiffness of a bitterness, cynicism. So it seems to me, to keep oneself free of both The rejection, condemnation, as well as the acceptance and conformity is absolutely necessary. I hope you won't look at the watch today, as I am not going to look at it. But I remember an event. I think it was 1966. And I was in Rome, Italy, speaking at some conference, world conference. And I knew that Krishnamurti was in the city. So we had a talk and I was having a meal with him. And there were some of his friends there. So one of his friends said to him, "Krishnaji, we are not free because of you." The person who spoke has been Krishnaji's classmate while Krishnamurti was studying. We call him Krishnaji, those who have known him in India. It's a kind of expression of affection and respect when you say Ji, Krishnaji, Jawaharlal Ji, Indira Ji, kind of endearment. So he said to Krishnaji, "We are not free because of you." And Krishnaji said, "Goodness me, how come?" And he said, "Look, we gave up all authority in one hand because we had you secure in the other." "Oh, I see," said Krishnaji. Great sadness, deep sadness floating in his eyes. And he said, "Look here, my friend. There was a monk living high up in the Himalayas. And he used to sit down for concentration or his idea of meditation long through the nights, deep into the nights. And it was winter. It was midnight and bitterly cold. It was a cave in which he was living. And the monk opened his eyes because he started feeling the chill and the biting cold. The fire had died out, so he wanted to make fire. He got up and looked around, but there was no wood to make the fire. He paced up and down in the cave, and suddenly his gaze fell upon the statue of Buddha, a wooden idol that he himself had carved out of a piece of wood years and years ago and had polished it and had worshipped it, cherished it with love. And he paced up and down in the cave, but he wanted to live. He broke the idol into pieces, made fire, and he lived. And proceeded Krishnaji, "So if someone is coming in your way of freedom, cut him down to pieces and throw him away, but be free for God's sake." So when we brush aside the authority of the knowledge, the authority of the past, the authority of the experience, if it is done in love and humility, if it is done out of compassion and not out of cynicism of bitterness, then there is no scar, no scratches and scars left on the consciousness. Indulgence in cynicism, bitterness, condemnation, contempt, arrogance, they leave their scars upon your psyche, you know. The consciousness gets mutilated. So you brush them aside and say, "I don't know, let me find out." But who will teach me? Life itself. When I begin to live, when I turn my face towards life and living, and I live my own understanding, whatever it is at that point, I begin to live that own understanding. then the understanding gets enriched by the actual living. When you live your understanding, you commit mistakes, you learn from the mistakes, there are failures, there are successes, whatever they be. But the actual living and the relationships are the fuel for the understanding to grow, to get nourished. The flame of understanding burns brighter and brighter by the day when it is correlated with daily living. So I begin to live my own understanding in my daily relationships. Life is my teacher. To keep oneself in the state of discipleship is enough. That is the first and the last step. Who will teach and who will not teach is an irrelevant question, because then life begins to tell its own story and uncover its secrets to you through the words of a child, through a gesture of a stranger, through the opening up of a bud, the trembling of a blade of grass, the note of a bird perched on a tree branch, then the darkness, the sunshine, the sorrow, the joy. They begin to uncover their secrets to you. When I do not impose my opinions, my preferences, my theories, my conclusions upon the facts of life, then the facts become very eloquent. And there is a dialogue between them and me. I hope you have noticed how life teaches. How life brings the inquirer and the understanding, the inquiry and understanding, vibrating in different persons together. You only have to remain in the state of learning, the vulnerability of discipleship. And life begins to teach. The words begin to talk to you. And this is not being said poetically. If there is any poetry in it, life is poetic, not the speaker. So you live your understanding. And that is the most difficult thing for us. If we falter at all, common people like you and me, we are used to collect knowledge, gather knowledge today, this moment, this hour, read the book, attend the talk, gather the ideas in the basket of memory and go home. The daily life is the home. And then I want to pick up an idea and live according to it in one relationship. Pick up another idea or thought and live, try to live according to it or up to it in another relationship. So our living is triangular. Hunt for ideas, thoughts. Listen to them, read them, collect them and store them in memory. And then go into relationships, trying to bring one after another the ideas and thoughts that were gathered, selected, chosen, rejected and so on. There is a time lag between the process of acquiring knowledge and the moment of manifesting them in our relationship. And we introduce incentives for that also. So, gathering knowledge, gathering incentives and then expressing them in life. This is our process. As long as we accept the authority of knowledge and try to live according to it, there will be this time lag. So we are used to it. So we say, well, I understand this, but I can't live that understanding because of my wife or the job or the service or the family or the society around me. I will live according to it tomorrow or after I retire from my service. Or from my job, or after 5 years or 2 years. Understanding has a momentum, has a dynamism, has an explosive nature, and we try to put the understanding in cold storage, in the refrigerators of our calculations, so that we can take piece by piece when it is convenient for us to lift the understanding. So a revolutionary inquirer says to himself, there is no tomorrow except in human mind. I live my understanding this day, this hour, this moment. Come what may, I live it because I want to live. And the rest is taken care of by life. A person who says to himself, I live my understanding this moment, this day, this hour, he goes through every relationship so thoroughly, so fully, with the wholeness of his being, he lives that moment with great intensity and depth of passion. Because he says, this is the moment where I meet the eternity, the immortality, or the infinity of life, or I miss it. So, which is wholeness, he is in that relationship. Whether there are tears to be gone through, or smiles to be gone through, whether it is pain to be gone through, and or the pleasure to be gone through, he lives the pleasure, or lives the pain, with the wealth of his wholeness. Now we are coming to a very significant point where living and dying blend together in the act of life. Where being born and dying get blended together in the act of living. See, the person pours his whole being, unwinds it, expresses it spontaneously, with the simplicity of his being, he is in that relationship. He tastes the message of infinity or eternity in that moment, in that movement, in that relationship so thoroughly that there is no need for him to look back upon that moment later on. He lives through the pain so thoroughly, so richly, without any inhibition. If the pain brings the tears, he goes through the tears. Doesn't try to suppress the tears, saying, oh well, tears are an indication of weakness, there must not be tears, or there must not be smile, and so on. He doesn't complicate the act of living by any theories, any conclusions, without any inhibitions of control, without any inhibitions of ideologies. He goes through that moment so richly, so thoroughly. And he has tasted the cup of that moment, movement or relationship to the last drop with the wholeness of his being and has finished with it. We don't do it. If something has hurt, someone has offended, someone has insulted, some has been violent with us, angry with us, this moment, the person goes away. And I am left with the wound, the memory, the scar of that hurt, that insult, that humiliation. And when the next moment someone else comes to meet me or see me, I am sitting there with pulling a long face, dejected, depressed. I look at that person through the smoke of my own suffering, of the memory of the pain. The pain is gone because you have lived the pain, through the pain at that moment. Now you are carrying to the next moment the shadow of that pain, the memory of that pain, the hurt. And you have a complaint, you have a grudge against life that you have been hurt. So the next person, the next challenge, the next situation, you meet under the burden, the pressure of the last relationship, the last moment, the last individual. So you look at him through the smoke, you don't see him clearly. Your vision is blurred. The eyes are clouded and the ears are blocked. So the next relationship is gone through absent-mindedly, distractedly. And naturally, there is no precision and accuracy when the ears are blocked and the eyes are clouded. So again something goes wrong and that hurt you carry along with you to the third relationship and the whole day is spoiled. Somebody says one thing to me in the morning and I say, goodness me, my whole day is gone. But the person had said something only in one moment. You are carrying it for the rest of the 23 hours and you nurse the hurt. Oh, poor me, this has been done unto me. And then you beg around for sympathy through your eyes. You want people to sympathize with you, to pat you on your back and say, oh yes, really, it has been terrible with you, and so on. Arousing, awakening pity and sympathy. Pity and sympathy is not love. The charity of pity and sympathy is very easy to indulge in for everyone when it is not his time to be depressed. And people come around with advice and suggestions and whatnot. That's not care, concern, affection or love. But that is how the relationships and the moments are spoiled, because we carry the burden of the last moment to the next, one relationship to the other. And by the end of the day, the mind is heavy with a variety of hurts and wounds, with a variety of annoyance and irritation, bitterness that we collect, go on gathering, and we try to suppress it. If somebody says, you look very sad, you look very depressed, we say, no, no, it's not that. So we are trying to suppress the anger, the annoyance, the irritation on one hand, nurse the wound on the other hand, and on the third hand, life doesn't wait for you, so you have to move through life. And then living becomes such an ugly problem. Not a simple, beautiful challenge, like a wave when you swim. There are waves in river, or if you swim at the seashore, there are waves. And you dance with the waves. You go with the wave, so that the wave does not drown you. You can ride over the wave and glide down, or go under it, and so on. So one has to learn to live with such a thoroughness, with the wholeness of one's being, every moment, through every relationship. So you finish the whole business of that relationship, of that challenge, at that very moment, and you can die to it. So that the next moment, you are fresh and innocent, like a newborn. And you can look around at people and listen to them. So, when I am out to learn, to grow, to discover, to find out, I cannot indulge in absent-mindedness, in attention, in sensitivity and so on. So I am there all the time, alert and sensitive. And that sensitivity and alertness brings about a beautiful way of living, that you are born every moment and you die every moment. That is to say, every relationship is fresh for you. You do not bring the stinking odor of the last relationship to the new one. That is how renunciation moves through relationships. Renunciation is not leaving your house or your wife or your husband or your children. Renunciation is the austerity to be alert, sensitive, and the austerity to go into every challenge and every relationship with the wholeness of your being. And you come out of it with the wholeness, undamaged, unscorched. But mind you, while you are going through that relationship, there will be the pain or the pleasure, because you have a form, you have a body, you have the conditionings of the past, you have the tastes. Not that everything is agreeable with the life of a person who lives in renunciation. That doesn't happen. Not that everything becomes very agreeable and smooth, a bed of roses without thorns, for a person living in enlightenment. Not that. He has his own suffering to go through, but he never allows the suffering to make him a morbid person. He goes through the suffering and finishes with it, has finished with it that very moment. When you go through pain or pleasure without inhibition, there is an end to the pleasure and the pain. And you move without fear in the next moment. It is only in such a state of renunciation that love blossoms. Love is a very tender and delicate flower. It blossoms in the soil of non-duality. It thrives on the waters of renunciation. And the human world today needs human beings who have the courage, who have the willingness to brush aside the authority of the past and be willing to move through relationships for learning, for growing, for discovering. Then only a new society where relationships are not based on authority, power, money would be possible. When one begins to live thus, then only transformation in the content of his psyche takes place. It is not a result of your particular activity, particular effort. Transformation is not the effect of a cause. But when a person begins to live with the wholeness of his being, for learning and not for acquiring, then the soil for transformation gets ready. It is a happening, not a result of an action. It is not a result of learning the techniques of Hatha Yoga or Raja Yoga or Mantra Yoga or Tantra Yoga or Zen Buddhist techniques. You may learn the techniques, develop the powers, sensitivize the body, but if there is no perspective of the totality, and if there is no relationship with the total life at every moment of life, then in the absence of that perspective, these techniques and methods will only develop the mental powers or the physical powers. But the revolutionary, radical mutation doesn't take place. One does not very much like to talk about oneself, but from the age of 7 onwards, the friend that is speaking to you had known a yogi and learned from him the Hatha Yoga and other things. He died at the age of 160. He had taught yoga for about 5 generations in our family. A great authority on Hatha Yoga. Wandering around in India, one has seen the yogis, the authorities of Tantra. One is not saying this on the authority of someone else's word, but after having seen the ashrams, the yogis, the sannyasis, talked with them, discussed with them. One says it with all humility, that learning techniques may develop the physical powers and the powers of the mind, the occult powers. It may enable you to have experiences in the occult and so on. But the transformation in the content of psyche, the radical transmutation in the psyche doesn't take place. The anger, the jealousies, the ambitions persist. The competitions, the comparisons persist, and so on, and so on. So for the transformation in the psyche is a happening. It takes place when one exercises knowledge wherever one has to deal with things man-made, where knowledge or organized information is absolutely necessary. One goes to school or college or reads at home, learns, educates oneself at home, But you cannot live in society without a modicum of knowledge. To know the nature of organized information and to use it in its relative field of utility is the skill that is needed. Yoga karmasu kaushalam. The state of yoga is the skill of moving through action and through relationships without friction. Samatvam yoga uchyate. The equanimity of your being, physical and mental, is the essence of yoga. You can refer to it in many ways. So, the the transformation takes place in the content of psyche when one exercises the knowledge, the experience, the conditionings, understanding their nature after having a personal acquaintance with them in their relative field of utility. And you have to use knowledge when you are in relationship in a man-made world, in a man-made society. But the man-made world is a tiny fragment of the whole life. The human relationships are a tiny fragment of your total relationship with the cosmic life, with the universal life. So, the world that is not man-made, one has to move in that world, brushing aside the authority of knowledge and experience. I had mentioned yesterday the realm of happening and the realm of doing. And I would conclude now. The time is perhaps already I have gone beyond the time. So I should not elaborate. I waited for a couple of minutes to check the momentum, to check the speed with which the communication was coming up, you know. So it took me nearly a minute to say to itself, yes, I know you want to come up, but be there. This is not the time now. So there is a realm of relationships where authority of knowledge and experience has to be brushed aside. It is irrelevant. And our relationship with human beings is one of those fields. When you are with another human being, please do not feel that you are in the realm of the known. You cannot know another person. You may have your guess. You may have your conjecture. You may have your theories. You may have your convictions, racial prejudices and preferences. But every individual being unique, you cannot rely even upon the authority of your experience of yesterday for meeting the man today. Human being is ever growing, unpredictable expression of life. And he is unpredictable because he contains within him the divinity, the infinity, the unnameable, the immeasurable intelligence in his heart. That is why human beings are unpredictable. You cannot impose upon them your theories and values, ideologies, criteria and standards. You can compare a car with another car. And you can have a like, saying that I like a Mercedes more than a Renault. Or you can say I like a Philips radio more than the Japanese. You can choose. And you may have your reasons for selection there. But among human beings, you cannot exercise likes and dislikes and opinions and cannot rely upon experience of other people or your own. That is the field where one has to be vulnerable. It is the field of happening. You be there in the simplicity of your being. Open out. Respond spontaneously or act according to the need of the moment. But to be with the other person with all the vulnerability and humility at one's command is the essence of love. In human relationships, no knowledge is ever relevant. No calculations are ever relevant, however mathematical they may be, sanely and logically worked out. So when one recognizes that there are different areas, the area where knowledge is vitally necessary and one has to use it competently and efficiently, and the area where one does not know anything, the area where innocence, openness and humility are the only ways of living. Otherwise you will fall back in the trap of knowledge and there will be a repetitive mechanical activity. That is the state of meditation. Beyond matter, beyond thought, when you are open and vulnerable to the happenings of life, in your relationship with other human beings and in relationship with nature, you are plunging into a realm where there is no movement of conditioned energy. Energy being matter, you are beyond all the conditioned energies and their conditioned forms of expression. And I may share with you that it is possible to live in that dimension and move from that dimension out into the daily living. Whether you cook a meal, wash the clothes, talk with the people, go for a walk, that state remains impregnable, undamaged. Thank you very much. This being the last talk, I transgressed the limits of my usual talks. Thank you.
Thank you so very much on behalf of us all, especially the Norwegians, for that you have been willing to share your heart blood and give us everything you have in these days in this camp, and for also be willing to come to a place you didn't know about and short knowing about it and staying here. We are very, very thankful.
Thank you, Irene.
Thank
you, Ingeborg.
And we also would like to thank Krishna Bhai for what has done to this place by being a wonderful person. And I will thank the Swedish people who have this place for giving us the opportunity to have the camp here in this beautiful condition, this place. Thank you, everybody.
Was that too stiff a talk?
Are you asking me?
Yes. Was it too difficult? So, goodbye to all of you.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
Very nice to meet you.